you are trying to use is not available on this line.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, symbolically.
Yeah, your symbol. Over in Signalville, I'm sorry, I keep saying that wrong, Signal Land, is Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And we have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
Signalville's on the West Coast. I have to remember that. Well, it's been another action-packed week in occupied land here, because that's how it feels week after week. Just one horrible thing after another happens, and it feels like we're kind of powerless to do anything about it. But, you know, we're not. We're not really powerless. We have power. We have this amazing place. We have WBAI. And I got to say, you know, the best thing you can do today to feel empowered and to do something good for your fellow citizen is to support WBAI. And perhaps somebody out there can give some specifics as to how to do that exactly, the exact website URL and maybe even a phone number and things like that. Does anybody have that?
We certainly can do that. You can, if you want to pledge to the station, you can go to Buddy, that's buddy.wbai.org. Or if you're telephonically inclined, you can call toll-free 833-922-4692 and give what you can to help us, to help keep us doing what we're doing at BAI. Let them know you're donating as a listener of Off the Hook. We always appreciate that. It helps us. It helps the station. And it helps you keep getting what we're putting out there. So, yes, buddy.wbai.org. You can make a one-time donation, or you can become a BAI buddy, which gives us a recurring donation from you of any amount you like. And it gives us the what's really unusual and really helpful in the world of nonprofits, which is a dependable income. It's so much easier to run a place like this when you know that you're getting some money on X and Y dates, and you can plan accordingly.
Exactly. Please remember that WBAI and the Pacifica Foundation are a 501c3 organization. Your giving to the station, giving to the Pacifica Foundation, is tax deductible. And if you have an individual retirement account and you need to make a qualifying charitable distribution this year, this is a great option for that. You can find the Pacifica Foundation EIN on the website at WBAI.org. You may have a corporate matching giving that you can do. You may have a donor advised fund. There are lots of ways to give to BAI. And if you give $25 or more over the course of the year, you become a voting member of WBAI. That is also a great benefit. you can vote in elections. And if you are a BAI buddy and you give us $5 a month, 5 months in, you do, in fact, become a member of the station. There is no downside here. Again, visit buddy.wbai.org to become a monthly sustaining donor. And again, the more regular donations we have to count on, the less we have to come to you for, and the better we all do. So please do feel free. If you have other questions about ways to donate, you can visit wbai.org/donate and learn all kinds of fun ways to do that. Yeah, check it out. And again, buddy.wbai.org is the best thing for everyone, so please do check that out.
Now, you don't have to pay very close attention to the news to come to the conclusion that we're being led by a group of petty tyrants that can't take criticism, that certainly aren't capable of doing the job, and it's just one carnival after another watching them in action. They have declared war on us. Because by us, I mean free-thinking people, I mean non-commercial radio, I mean, you know, anybody who has the chutzpah to say anything against what is currently happening right now. You do that, and all of a sudden you're in the crosshairs like Harvard, you know, where you stand up for yourself and you are a threat. Here at WBAI, we make NPR pale by comparison because we speak our minds and we don't apologize for that. And the things that we say are things that the powers that be certainly do not want us to say. They don't want us to talk about, they don't want us to be around at all. You know, if they could, they would deport all of us. And they're working towards that. They really are. You don't have to use any imagination to get to that conclusion. That's why it's so important to not have to worry about how we're going to pay the rent, you know, or something. You know, I don't want to say trivial because rent is anything but trivial for many of our listeners and certainly for us. But it's something that shouldn't be front and foremost in our minds. We should be doing the hard-hitting investigating and exposing of corruption and hypocrisy and all the other things that are in abundance right now. We've seen countless instances of mainstream media buckling under, being cowards, retracting statements, even paying money to the president's causes, because they're afraid. The same thing with corporate America, non-media. The same thing with the big tech companies. They are all terrified. Why? Because they have so much to lose. They've made billions, more probably, and it could all go away if the petty tyrant in charge decides they are the enemy. He can make life very, very difficult for them. So they do not want that. And that's why you're seeing less a corporate backing of pride marches, less a corporate support for anything that criticizes Donald Trump and his kind. That's why you're seeing so much in the way of hypocrisy. People that you thought were doing the right thing, all of a sudden doing something else completely differently. You're seeing it in academia. You're seeing some universities that just are agreeing to do whatever they're told instead of doing what is right and what any academic institution would support. Freedom of speech, questioning, rebellion, all of that. It's healthy and it's necessary, especially in these times. So that's why. That's why it's important to have a strong voice, especially in a place like New York City. You know, we have many non-commercial radio stations, and I'm happy for every single one of them. But there's something very special about WBAI. For one thing, we're the most middle of the dial that you can get. We're at 99.5. There's a whole story behind that we don't have time for. But most non-commercial stations are shunted over to the left of the dial, below 92. There are a couple of exceptions, but we're in the middle. That, you know, it's doesn't really mean anything except that a lot of people find us by accident because they're not in the non-commercial zone. They're in the commercial zone. They're looking for a commercial station. And all of a sudden, wow, you're listening to a radio show about hackers. How did that happen? Well, it's been happening since 1960. Not the show about hackers, but non-commercial radio at 99.5 FM in New York City. And it's no coincidence that WBAI is one of the longest living stations in New York City. If you go to any frequency on the dial, there is a story behind that particular frequency and how it once played a different type of music or had a different format and then was bought and traded and just changed to something completely different, leaving many of its listeners disappointed and upset that something they were depending on had disappeared. Now, we have not been without struggle and without challenges to our own frequency, to our own broadcasting license, and in fact, to this day, we still are. But we always come back. We always come back. You might find several stories of how this place has been shut down, but we are always back, and we are always doing the same thing, which is asking you for support and broadcasting rebellious, independent, creative radio. And there's very, very few stations like that left. But I'm proud to be part of this one. So, anyway, buddy.wbai.org, please support this place. Support it in droves. Because if it does go away, if it is shut down by people who are afraid of freedom of speech, it's not going to come back. It's not going to come back if they win, and we can't let that happen. All right, let's get into the show because we have a lot of things to talk about tonight. First of all, let's stay with the White House for a moment because this is what's known as a delicious story. The White House is investigating after one or more people reportedly accessed the contacts from the personal phone of White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles and used the information to contact other top officials and impersonate her. Oh, I would have loved to have heard that. Wiles reportedly told people that her phone was hacked. I could just hear her saying it, too. The Wall Street Journal first reported the hack of Wiles's phone, and CBS News has also confirmed that report. I don't know why CBS News had to confirm what the Wall Street Journal said. Okay, well, fine. Everybody agrees. The hacker or hackers are said to have accessed her phone contacts, including the phone numbers of other top U.S. officials and influential individuals. The Wall Street Journal reports some contacts received phone calls impersonating Wiles, which used, get ready, artificial intelligence to impersonate her voice, and also sent text messages from a number not associated with her. Yeah. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly would not say, when asked by TechCrunch, not TechCrunch is involved in the story, if authorities had determined if a cloud account associated with her personal device was compromised or if her phone was targeted by a more advanced cyber attack, such as one that involves the use of government-grade spyware. Yeah. In response, the White House said it takes the cybersecurity of all staff very seriously, and this matter continues to be investigated. Yeah, okay. Good luck with that. This is the second time Wiles has been targeted by hackers. She hasn't been around that long, right? 2024? Okay, last year. The Washington Post reported that Iranian hackers had attempted to compromise her personal email account. Wall Street Journal said Friday, citing sources, the hackers were in fact successful in breaking into her email and obtained a dossier on Vice President J.D. Vance, then Trump's running mate. This is the latest cybersecurity incident to beset the Trump administration in the months since taking office. And, you know, it really hasn't been that long. You know, there's what we can fit them on one hand still, right? January, February, March, April. Okay, two hands. But it's not much, not many months. And they've had quite a few incidents. In March, former White House top national security advisor Michael Waltz mistakenly added a journalist to a Signal group of top White House officials, including Vance and Wiles, which included discussions of a planned military airstrike in Yemen. That's not really a breach. That's just a dumbass, right? It's somebody doing something they're not supposed to do. But plenty of time for breaches. Reports later revealed that the government officials were using a Signal clone app called Telemessage, which was designed to keep a copy of messages for government archiving. Telemessage was then subsequently hacked on at least two occasions, revealing the contents of its users' private messages. Check and mate. So that's what happens when you have people in charge that don't know what they're doing. Yeah, it happens. You know, it happens almost everywhere. But when it happens here, I don't know. It just seems to be extra special somehow. They put extra ingredients into their cyber attacks, into their security breaches. Thoughts?
No. Sure. I could jump in here on a number of things with that particular story, but I find it really troubling when you have all these federal officials that have seemingly just incessant problems with cybersecurity and cyber hygiene generally. And the first response that they always have is, my phone was hacked. I was hacked. This was hacked. The device was hacked, without providing any further details about the device, the methodology of the hack, without giving any indication as to what the hell had happened to the particular phone, and whether they were exercising due care over that data and that device and the classified and other unclassified but controlled information they may have that belongs to the federal government. So I'm getting really tired of this my device was hacked nonsense. I feel like we should be demanding a lot more information about this. I mean, we're a much more mature populace right now that understands these things. We've got lots of technical experts and no shortage of people willing to opine in the media, like the show, about how these things could happen. So I think it's high time we demand some more details about this, and we should not allow, and the media should not allow, these federal officials to just seemingly claim that their phones were hacked anymore.
Well, you know, we're doing a lot of demanding lately. You know, I mean, Chuck Schumer is always demanding things, always writing letters. How do we ensure that we get answers? Because I don't think they're going to tell us anything. We just have to kind of theorize as to what happened, what kind of mistake was made. I mean, yeah, she said her phone was hacked. Okay, how? Susie, how did that happen exactly? You know, did you use a stupid password? Did somebody shoulder surf? Did you use an app that you didn't know where it came from? You know, there's so many ways that you can be compromised. It's important. You know, you're the White House chief of staff. That's kind of an important job. So we need to make sure that you're employing the basic security measures, you know, the basic ones.
Well, and to add to that, Manuel, I think that the public would have a right to know whether or not this was some kind of a zero-day type of attack or a zero-click kind of attack. That would be some kind of indication that a nation was behind a particular attack on the chief of staff as opposed to some kind of ordinary fraudster or cyber criminal. And in this particular instance, I might be wrong, but I think that the FBI did rule out that nations were behind this, meaning that nations were not behind this particular attack, as I understand it, what I've read, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, how do you rule that out? How exactly do you do that?
Well, I guess you would have to perform some kind of forensics on this and look at the sophistication involved in the attack. And if you're ruling out nation states being behind this, then it probably wasn't a hell of a sophisticated attack that resulted in however the breach occurred on this particular device.
Right. I'm not trying to be difficult here, but what if a nation state simply realizes that they don't need to use something sophisticated to compromise a particular person, and they just hire, you know, some ordinary person to do this, and then it doesn't seem like a nation state, but it is.
Well, that happens all the time. That happens all the time. There are initial access brokers that sophisticated APTs or advanced persistent threats or nation states will use in order to make those types of initial breaches of whether it's a device, a company, an account, et cetera, and it gives them some kind of plausible deniability or at least breaks that chain of attribution, makes it much more difficult for somebody to figure out whether or not there is a sophisticated actor on the other side. And in this case, it doesn't sound like there was a great deal of sophistication needed to breach the chief of staff here.
Well, can we imagine the kind of harm that could be done or that might have been done? And you just have to wonder what kinds of security measures are or are not being taken in this group of people. All right, here's another story about somebody who tried to do something. Maybe it was well-intentioned, but boy, it was stupid. This is a 28-year-old who is a a cybersecurity employee at the Defense Intelligence Agency. His name is Nathan Latch. He had a top secret clearance, worked in the Insider Threat Division. I'm sorry, that's just a really cool name of a place to work, Insider Threat Division. He spent his days enabling user monitoring on individuals with access to Defense Intelligence Agency, known as DIA, systems, including employees under surreptitious internal investigation. So if you work for the division that investigates people that work for the or work for any division, I guess you can feel like you're invincible, that you'll find out if you're being investigated. So, yeah, he was one of those, according to this Ars Technica story, who watched the watchers. He appears to have had supreme confidence in his own ability to avoid detection should he decide to go rogue. Stupid mistakes made by other idiots would not be difficult for me to avoid, he once wrote. Oh, how many times have I heard that? DIA wouldn't even launch an investigation of him without him knowing something was up, as we said. Now, Latch earned a cybersecurity degree from Florida Polytechnic in 2018, and he soon found himself with access to serious government secrets at DIA, which he joined in 2019. He eventually had not only a top secret clearance, but was also read into various quote-unquote special access programs, some of the government's deepest secrets. He appears to have been relatively gruntled about his work. And I'm sorry, I just have to stop there and say that one sentence has been all over the Internet this past week. Just people love that sentence. He appears to have been relatively gruntled about his work. I've never used it in my life. I'm just enjoying saying it right now. But for the purposes of people who might not know, obviously disgruntled means you're not happy with something. So if you're gruntled, I guess that means you're happy. Is that a way of saying, Alex, does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. And it's interesting, too, that you hear the words gruntled and disgruntled used very often in the context of federal employees, because it was always a disgruntled postal worker.
I hear that. I've never heard gruntled before.
Yeah, gruntled is very unusual. And I'm not sure if it's some kind of neologism or something like that, but, you know, that came out of the word disgruntled. But it's certainly interesting. Yeah.
Go ahead, Gayla.
Gruntled apparently roots back to the 1600s.
Well, it hasn't been used since then, I guess. It's coming back now.
But apparently gruntled 1500s, 1600s, it meant something different, but yeah.
It meant something different?
Apparently it came from the word grumble.
Okay.
Is kind of where it came from, but yeah, I mean, it has become more popular, I think, gruntled as a word has existed since the 1500s.
It doesn't look like a word that means happy. Gruntled. It looks like a word that means you're upset about something. But anyway, let's move on. So, yeah, he'd been relatively gruntled about his work, but the political upheavals of the last decade shook his faith in what America stood for and the objectives his work was serving. And by March of this year, Latch had achieved full disgruntlement and allegedly sent an anonymous email to a, quote, friendly foreign government, unquote, and there's relatively few of those left, offering to share classified information with them. The email said that the recent actions of the current administration are extremely disturbing to me. I do not agree or align with the values of this administration and intend to act to support the values that the United States at one time stood for. And, you know, admirable statement. I agree with that. It's just the way he went about it, probably not the smartest thing to do. The FBI, and this is the weird part, the FBI was soon provided with this email. I guess whoever he contacted the FBI. They quickly found out that Latch was not nearly as good a security as he thought he was. What this story did was go over the various mistakes there. So if you're somebody currently working in a government agency with a name like, what were they again? Insider Threat Division. Yeah, if you're working for somebody like that and you're feeling less gruntled than usual, keep in mind these things, because these are the mistakes he made. Redaction fail. The anonymous email included two photos, including the front and back of a U.S. government ID card, of the kind used in the intelligence agency. Now, while he removed his name and photo, there was other information there that was not redacted on one of the U.S. government IDs, and law enforcement was able to determine that the U.S. government ID belonged to him through that. I don't know why you needed to send an ID in the first place. Obviously, that's very, very dangerous. Then email address. The FBI quickly gained access to the quote-unquote anonymous email address used to send the message. They found that on the day that this account was set up, it received a message from a second email account, possibly as a test, which turned out to be one of Latch's and contained his name as part of the email address. That right there, that's all you need, really. But there's more. The email account, the second email account, when the FBI examined it, had been set up using Latch's full name, date of birth, and phone number. Yeah. Then the IP address. Both the first and second email account had been logged into from the same IP address, suggesting they were controlled by the same person. And the IP address that was used for them both resolved to Latch's residence. I almost, you know, I feel sorry for him at this point. Boy, so much he could have learned. Now, he, to his credit, suggested moving the conversation to an encrypted messaging platform, but that was after all this had happened. So, yeah, kind of not the best idea. I'm not sure what it was he offered. I'm not sure what it was that he was going to give to this friendly government. An extraordinarily stupid thing to do. And I feel bad. I feel bad that somebody whose heart was in the right place, realizing that very bad things are going on and somebody has to do something, put himself in jeopardy in this way. And I don't know what's going to happen with this administration. Anything is possible. I do know there are a lot more people like that, and I hope they make better decisions, and I hope they're more successful. Does anybody want to offer their opinions on this? Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, sure. I can jump in as a former federal employee. I guess I can sense that type of frustration that this person may have had, and I think they had their intentions in the right place, but they should have known better, especially having gone through the security clearance processing to obtain what is presumably TSSCI, or top secret with access to sensitive compartmented information, especially if he had access to what appeared to be compartmented levels of programs, kind of special access programs and things like that. So, you know, this is somebody who should have been familiar with the ordinary channels for whistleblowing types of activities. But I do sympathize with him in a sense, because you have the Trump administration having terminated lots of the inspector generals of the various agencies and departments, and it probably feels like a very unsafe place to be a whistleblower or to disclose this type of information over to the media, for example. So maybe he thought handing it over to a foreign government that's also used to handling classified information would be the most secure way of doing this. But in so doing that, he made himself into a counterintelligence threat to the United States and seems to have been very easily picked up. So it's tough, and I do, I just have to say, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are just leaving government because they disagree with the actions of the administration. You know, we see that quite a bit within FBI and elsewhere.
Or because they're getting fired.
Or because they're getting fired as well. But it just, there aren't a lot of avenues left for these people to blow the whistle. That's a really, really big problem.
Well, this is an important thing to remember. We're saying classified information. When you say that, you know, you think the worst. You think, you know, missiles and all kinds of security things. This could have been something that we want to know about, that we should know about, something incredibly corrupt and evil that he was trying to get out. And we don't know what that is. It could be anything. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, it's. I'm also fascinated by the Ars Technica article here. Goes into how he got busted. Basically, the FBI had a sting operation set up, posing as the friendly country he was trying to contact, and so they told him, "Yeah, go get us some data." They watched him on video, copying data into notebooks by hand, tearing the pages off and stuffing them in his socks, and Then he wrote up his notes, stored them on a thumb drive, and dropped them as requested by his contact, who was really a Fed, out in the park. And he had told his contact, and this is kind of a heartbreaking quote, he told his contact that he wasn't seeking money, but, quote, citizenship for your country, because he didn't expect things here to improve in the long term, even in the event that there is a change in the future. And just reading those words, I know so many people who feel like this right now. I know so many people who are giving up, or at least very much considering giving up, because the fight seems so overwhelming right now. It's very easy to feel isolated in this. It's very easy to feel alone in wanting to make things better. And it's very easy to kind of fall down your own rabbit hole, do something stupid like this, and suffer the consequences. And it's my heart does go out to this guy, because it seems like his heart was in the right place, even if his head was right up his, you know. Anyway.
Well, let's try and keep track of where the story goes, because we shouldn't forget about people that do things like this, and hopefully people make better decisions. But, you know, to answer your point, Rob, a lot of people are feeling this way. I'm feeling this way. Many of us are. You feel better when you know there are more people that understand, that feel the same way. You know, Kyle and I were driving the other day. We came upon a demonstration just in the middle of nowhere, a demonstration against all of this crap that's going on. We didn't know about this. It's an organization called Indivisible. Indivisible.org is their website. But there were a lot of people on the street, and every car passing was honking support. This is on Long Island. You know, you would think that it would be something a bit more hostile towards them. I felt so good after seeing that. We need to do this more. We need to reach out to people more and just be comforting, because that's super important. And by the way, June 14th, Flag Day, also Trump's birthday, and the anniversary of the Army or Navy or one of them, that's when this big military parade is supposed to be happening in Washington, D.C. There is a groundswell of opposition to that kind of militarization of our society. Because, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen here, and now all of a sudden it's going to start happening. People are planning all sorts of things for that day, so it's going to get interesting. Kyle.
Yeah, I believe...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I believe specifically that's the No Kings action on that day, and we've advocated, and I think many people are thinking the same way, that the way these things will thrive is through spontaneity, and... But with a dash of classic sort of organization, because you have to have a way to get the word out and to get numbers, you know, get a lot of people to actually show up. But in smaller actions distributed all over the country, there's a lot of power and a lot of visibility, because you, in the case of what we saw, you are presenting opposition. Maybe during someone's commute home, those people may be inclined, but may not realize politically inclined to ally with or agree with some of what you're protesting. But they may not feel as much support. So it is ongoing, and you may not be aware of it. You kind of have to dig for some of this stuff, but groups like Indivisible have pretty good mapping and news alerts, and if maybe not you directly, but someone in one of your smaller organizations is on the list or subscribes to some of that, they'll get the word out to you, and those kinds of things. That word of mouth can be really, really powerful. Or if you see an action going on, ask, how do I find out more? How do I find out when the next one is? That simple gesture will probably get you exactly what you need as far as the who, what, when, and where. And anybody who wants to inform us about stuff that is going on, or news around ways to organize or tips for becoming more visible in the face of some of this onerous stuff, specifically surveillance, I know we're going to get to that later, please write us, oth@2600.com, and we'll air it here, especially stuff around surveillance and privacy and keeping people safe when they are exercising their rights.
You know, something else that I know a lot of people have been super frustrated with is what's going on with immigration, with especially immigration courts, where people showing up for their hearings to become citizens of this country are, after their hearings, being ambushed by armed thugs. I have no other word for it. That basically throw them into a van and take them away someplace. We never know where. Sometimes it's to somewhere in Texas. Sometimes it's to El Salvador. It's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. And it's making people afraid to show their faces and to be at the hearings that they are legally entitled to be at. You know, the whole system is being bypassed. I did a little bit of digging, not much at all. I just looked on the Justice Department's website, justice.gov, and I was able to find every single immigration court is listed there. And not only that, but you can listen to all of the hearings that take place. There's a single phone number. I'm going to give you a phone number because it's on their website. It's area code 415, that's the Bay Area, 527-5035. And all you have to do is pick a judge in a court, and every judge has a code. I don't mean a code of justice. I mean a code for the phone. For instance, looking at New York here, I see we have the Broadway Immigration Court, which is located at the Ted Weiss Federal Building, 290 Broadway, 15th floor. We have the Federal Plaza Immigration Court, 26 Federal Plaza, 12th floor, room 1237. We have the Varick Immigration Court, 201 Varick Street, 5th floor, room 507. I imagine they have more than one room for courts because they have a lot of judges. But, you know, if we want to pick one, for instance, in the Broadway Immigration Court, let's see, John Burns. His code is 19995414409. I'm not giving out any secret information. It's right there on their own website. Now, there are several things you can do. You can listen to the hearings to see if the hearings are fair and to see how they're treating people. You can also show up at these places because it makes the work of ICE so much harder if there's a mob of people in their way. And a lot of us are being surprised by these actions. But this is where the actions are taking place, at the courthouses, outside the courtrooms. And if we are serious about stopping it from happening, well, here are the addresses. Justice.gov, look for the immigration courts. It's all right there. I don't know how much longer it's going to be there for. Knowing Trump, he'll take it down. But that's why we have archive.org. And please support them, too, because they are absolutely magical. You can access internet-based hearings of any court, and all the information, all the instructions are there. Alex, did you know that this existed? Alex?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yeah, I was on mute there for a second. It's quite interesting, but I think it's a really important call to action here because it allows public participation in these types of proceedings. I wouldn't say participation. I guess it allows for transparency, right? You're supposed to be silent and watch and listen to these types of things. But, yeah, I think it's really important. And it's, you know, a lot of these proceedings are very highly accessible, whether you're in a federal court, a state court, an immigration court. And we should be watching and listening.
Yeah, and the idea of ambushing somebody who is going through legal channels to resolve their situation, it's just so sleazy and horrible. You know, I am all for somebody who is wanted for a crime, and I'm not talking about simply existing in this country being the crime. I'm talking about violent criminals, people who are wanted. Yes, I don't think anybody's going to argue that those people should be found, intercepted, and prevented from walking around on the streets and victimizing more people. But we're talking about families here. We're talking about people who, like our ancestors, have simply looked for a better way of life. And they're following the rules, they're doing everything right, and they are being treated like criminals by people who are not part of that particular court system. And, you know, they even arrested a judge for trying to protect one of the people that she had a hearing for. You know, in a courtroom, the judge says what goes. You know, anything that they decree, that's the way it is. That's how judges are. And to introduce this new element of armed stormtroopers outside that are going to grab the person that you give a particular amount of time before the next hearing to, it's just, it's against everything that this country stands for. Alex, go ahead. We're going to get one more story.
It's part of this tripartite and highly deplorable attack on the justice system itself. I mean, we've seen the administration target judges. We've seen them target separation of powers. We've seen them target lawyers. We've seen them target law firms. Why would they stop there? You want to go for the individual litigants as well. Make them afraid to even show up in court. Make it an access to justice issue here. I mean, this is just a part and parcel of, I think, a wholesale attack on the entire system of justice that we have come to understand in this country. They want people to feel uneasy. They want to instill a sense of disquietude for anybody who is showing up to one of these proceedings because they don't want you to. They don't want you to participate in this. You have to think about the legal system as something that is really, it's a matter of publicly funded dispute resolution. You know, it's our taxpayers that pay for this. We should feel safe in those buildings, and we should respect the judicial officials and their orders, and this is something that is not happening, and it's coming from on high, and it's extraordinarily dangerous precedent.
Well, we have the Constitution on our side, and we have a lot of people on our side, so we need to start using both and clogging up this mechanism that is being abused. All right, we have one final story, but it's a big story, and it's a story we're going to be coming back to many, many times. It's about this this organization, company, corporation, whatever you want to call them, called Palantir. You all heard of them? Yeah, in March, they've been around for a while. Trump signed an executive order 2 months ago, 3 months ago, calling for the federal government to share data across agencies, raising questions over whether he might compile a master list of personal information on Americans that could give him untold surveillance power. Yeah, because the Trump administration has been expanding Palantir's work across the federal government in the last couple of months. Now, the company's received more than $113 million in federal government spending since Trump took office, including additional funds from existing contracts as well as new contracts with DHS and the Pentagon. Representatives of Palantir are also speaking to at least two other agencies, Social Security Administration, Internal Revenue Service, about buying its technology, according to six government officials and Palantir employees with knowledge of the discussions. They're putting a key Palantir product known as Foundry into at least four federal agencies, DHS, the Health and Human Services Department, among others, and basically the idea of creating detailed portraits of Americans based on government data is not just a pipe dream. The Trump administration has already sought access to hundreds of data points on citizens and others through government databases, including their bank account numbers, the amount of their student debt, their medical claims, any disability status. Now, Trump could potentially use such information to advance his political agenda by policing immigrants and punishing critics. It's not much of a reach to get to this conclusion. Privacy advocates, student unions, labor rights movements, organizations either have filed lawsuits to block data access, questioning whether the government could weaponize people's personal information. What do you think? Look at their actions. Of course they're going to weaponize it. Of course they're going to abuse it. Now, some current and former Palantir employees have been unnerved by the work. The company risks becoming the face of Trump's political agenda, and could be vulnerable if data on Americans is breached or hacked. Correction, when it's breached or hacked. Several tried to distance the company from the effort, saying any decisions about a merged database of potential of personal information rest with Trump and not the firm. Have to disagree on that. You're providing the ingredients to do this, and you can't disavow any responsibility. Now, this month, 13 former employees signed a letter urging Palantir to stop its endeavors with Trump. Linda Zia, a signee who was a Palantir engineer until last year, said the problem was not with the company's technology, but with how the Trump administration intended to use it. Again, you know, we have been saying this for decades, that the technology is neutral. It's how it's used, and every bit of good technology is also going to be used for evil. You can't just pretend you're discovering this now. When you create something, when you invent something, assume it's going to be used by the most evil people on earth and ask yourself if that's worth pursuing, because guaranteed it's going to fall into their hands. Kyle.
Yeah, and let's not forget that this is for profit. So they want to make money doing this. And I'm not going to tell people what to do, but I will say what I think. I don't think they deserve this business model. I think the company itself should be disintegrated, like just basically crippled, however that happens, legal and otherwise. And I think that their technology should be involuntarily open sourced or freed up so that everyone can do what they will with this innovation, and they can go the way of the dustbin.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
This is rape. It's digital data rape.
It has been described that way. It has been described that way, and it's of a nature that I don't think we have seen before. And it's terrifying a number of people. Yes, Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Kyle on a lot of these points here. I mean, this is something that's not neutral. I mean, for them to say, we're building tools, this is a hammer, what you do with it is totally different. I mean, let's be very clear here. They're building really sophisticated tools that enable data integration and analytics. And those tools are going to amplify the reach of these abhorrent policies. These policies that infringe on civil liberties, these policies that enable things like mass surveillance and profiling of American citizens, infringing our civil liberties, infringing our civil rights, invading our privacy rights. This crazy tools, not policy argument is really a little bit of sophistry, I think, to deflect any measure of ethical responsibility. This is a totally insane argument, and there are so many issues that go along with this Palantir, Trump administration expansion of these powers and the integration of this data. There are, I think, going to be a copious amount of legal challenges, hopefully coming from organizations like the ACLU and the EFF, about this type of authoritarian overreach, about violations of the Privacy Act, about violations of the E-Government Act. You know, we as citizens, even though we don't have necessarily an overarching federal privacy legislation, we still do have the Privacy Act of 1974 that allows us to access records that the government holds about individual citizens. I think this will make it extraordinarily difficult for us to exercise those rights, and I think that this practice, if it goes forward without any kind of meaningful oversight body, would arguably violate that law, as well as maybe half a dozen others.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I just want to build on the Privacy Act comment. This should usher in a tsunami of the most enormous, massive privacy legislation this country has ever seen. I'm tired of this. We are tired of this. These companies have been allowed to do this kind of stuff. They've created, what is it, surveillance capitalism, these all of these things we talked about ad nauseum. I'm tired of it. We're tired of it collectively. And we've talked about enacting a privacy legislation very much like other parts of the world have, and it has not gotten over our political hurdles or the sort of social will. If they get their way, and if it doesn't, I'd be really disappointed. If they get their way, it very much should. It ought to be what pushes this idea of privacy as a right and putting it to law for Americans. It should usher it in. I mean, it should be the straw that breaks the camel's back in this scenario.
This is something that I don't think it's a left or right issue. I think anybody who cares about privacy and freedom would be outraged by the potential that's being unleashed here. Now, Palantir was founded back in 2013 by Alex Karp and Peter Thiel, which are names I think people might recognize. We don't have time to really go into that now, but there's a lot of baggage and a lot of questions are being asked about all this. But can anyone sum up in the 2 minutes we have just maybe something that would wake people up as to why this is more of a threat than all the other privacy intrusions that we have seen? Alex, go ahead.
I mean, this is really crazy. When you have the aggregation of such sensitive data, when you have banking information, student loans, medical claims, things like disability status, data from multiple federal agencies aggregated into some single analytical platform that the administration has access to, this could result in, you know, no joke, unprecedented government surveillance capabilities. You know, things like, you know, real-time monitoring of our transactions, of our locations. Now, this is really, really crazy. This could begin to resemble something like China's social credit system, where you have this authoritarian regime constantly monitoring what its citizens are doing. especially if this information is going to be shared with law enforcement, with ICE. This could erode our Fourth Amendment expectations if challenges are not brought against this type of action rather quickly and forcefully, as Kyle had, I think, rightfully suggested. And I think one of the things to also think about here, too, is that a lot of loyal supporters of Trump have actually signaled their displeasure with this type of thing, because even they are concerned about a massive national database about U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that we have to stay on top of. We're out of time now, but we are certainly going to continue this discussion both on Overtime, which immediately follows this program, on YouTube. Go to 2600.com, look at the link at the top of the page, or just go to Channel 2600 on YouTube and join us there. Or keep listening to Off the Hook every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 here on WBAI. We'll be discussing that more in the future.
Let's create consequences.
I like that. I like that. That's a bumper sticker. A little long, but we can make it work. All right, everyone, you're not alone. We're out there. We'll see you soon. Good night.